Deadline White House is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. Justice Stephen Breyer making it official today, announcing his retirement after 28 years on the U.S. Supreme Court, a tenure that witnessed five presidents, two major wars, and dramatic and sweeping changes to our country. At an event at the White House earlier today, President Joe Biden paid tribute to Justice Breyer and his years of public service.
Through it all, Justice Breyer has worked tirelessly to give faith to the notion that the law exists to help the people. I think he's a model public servant in a time of great division in this country. Justice Breyer has been everything his country could have asked of him.
President Biden also promised to nominate Breyer's replacement by the end of February, which would make it almost exactly 2 years after he first pledged to appoint a black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court, a promise which Biden ally and Majority Whip Jim Clyburn tells NBC News did more than anything else to propel Joe Biden to the Democratic nomination and ultimately to the presidency. President Biden repeated that promise today.
The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view.
Breyer's decision to retire has electrified Washington, D.C., adding a major legacy-making item to the president's agenda, one that could galvanize the Democratic base at a time of somewhat sagging approval ratings and with some of the president's signature legislation stalled amid gridlock in Washington. From the Post, the news Wednesday came as a relief for liberal activists who have worried that Democrats would lose control of the Senate before Breyer left the court, and a much-needed shot of confidence to Democratic leaders who view the politics of the high court this year as a bright spot in an otherwise gloomy election season. President Biden has promised to nominate the first black woman to the high court, a prospect his party hopes will excite his core supporters by delivering on a campaign promise, keeping the politics of abortion in the headlines, and reminding Democrats of the importance of holding on to Senate control. The challenge for Democrats, getting a nominee that fits the bill through the confirmation process in a 50-50 Senate, where Republicans are already gearing up to oppose the yet-to-be-named nominee. The New York Times reporting this, quote, holding a bare 50-seat majority that is under severe threat in November's midterm elections, Democrats acknowledge the need to act fast, particularly since an illness or death of one of their members could deprive them of their numerical advantage and greatly complicate efforts to fill the seat. Senate Democrats are reportedly meeting today to discuss strategy, a source telling NBC News that Democrats are hoping to confirm a nominee on a timeline similar to that of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Of course, she was confirmed 30 days after her nomination was announced by Trump. Now all eyes turn to the White House as it considers potential nominees who will, of course, not change that ideological composition on the court, but could, at least, cement the liberal lean of Breyer's seat for decades to come. Democrats moving full speed ahead to fill a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court is where we start this hour. Former Republican strategist Steve Schmidt is here. Also joining us, former Obama campaign manager and MSNBC political analyst David Plouffe is back. Kimberly Atkins-Storr is here again, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe and an MSNBC contributor. And Alexi McCammon's back, political reporter for Axios and an MSNBC contributor. Alexi, I know you write today about this opportunity, which really does electrify Washington, being a lifeline potentially for Democrats. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk to Dems, whether that's with the national party organizations or some of these women I spoke to yesterday who are the presidents of women's groups or reproductive rights groups, who say that this will not only keep abortion in the headlines, but things like voting rights, things like immigration. And to their bigger picture point, Nicole, this is something you'll appreciate. They think this gives Democrats an opportunity to really contrast the larger party with the Republican Party, which is something Democrats haven't been focused too much on in the last several weeks and months. But they say that they'll be able to remind voters not just what Democrats stand for and what they're fighting for, but all the things that Republicans are fighting against and all the rights they say that they're trying to take away, not just from people, but from women and Black women in particular.
You know, it's such an interesting piece of reporting and analysis. And we spend a lot of time covering the court because they have almost moved into this role of sort of arbiters of some of the most hotly debated and, as you said, divisive policies. But what makes the court, I think, a potential loser for Republicans is that the court is about to overturn things with vast public support. I mean, Roe v. Wade enjoys 63% of support from Americans who would like it to stay exactly as it is. And that excludes some of the policies advocated by activists on both sides. The total ban that went into effect in Florida, more liberal abortion policies that, frankly, aren't being pushed much of anywhere anymore. But I wonder what the sort of consternation is, if the Republican Party is capable of any, about having the court be front and center all year.
I mean, I think you know this well, Nicole. The Republican Party is often not in lockstep with what polls show voters want. And that's true of abortion, as you said, but that's also true of something like vaccine and mask mandates. Polls and focus groups show that Americans, parents in particular, aren't as, in opposition to these things as the Republican Party continues to be. And I think that that is something that they don't care about because they know that they can use the Supreme Court to beef up this larger narrative around the culture wars. It doesn't matter necessarily what the polls show about, you know, support for abortion or Roe v. Wade being constitutional law. Republicans know how to strike a nerve and a chord with their voters and know that voters can often be emotional instead of rational when it comes to voting or telling a pollster how they feel about things. And so I think that while Democrats feel that they have polling and legislation and policy ideas on their side, they know that Republicans are better at controlling the narrative in spite of those things. And I think that's what Republicans are going to continue to lean on.
David Plouffe, if you disagree, please do so. But I don't know that there's anyone more important to President Joe Biden being able to turn around his presidential aspirations during the Democratic primary season than Jim Clyburn. Let me show you something that Jim Clyburn said. He has very strong views. He's been talking about them publicly for a very long time about who he'd like to see fill this seat.
I have been discussing Michelle Childs with the president and his people now for at least 13 months. She has what I call the kind of background and experiences that we ought to have. I am very, very concerned that we take on this elitist kind of atmosphere when we pretend that the only way you can demonstrate, let's say, qualifications is to go to certain schools. Well, I don't think that's right.
So, David Plouffe, I mean, just take me through three things. You know, one, how does any president deal with their most important backer, or one of their most important backers, being so public in their advocacy? And, you know, the argument he's making is a very powerful one. Talk about how this White House navigates both those things.
Well, Nicole, Jim Clyburn is one of the few people in history who can say they're a maker of presidents. So that is true. I don't think that Joe Biden, though, you know, this is a former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was vice president when Barack Obama put two people on the court. So I don't think he's going to feel overly compelled to pick Jim Clyburn's choice. Now, his argument about elitism, of course, Joe Biden went to the University of Delaware, Steve Schmidt and I's alma mater, and Syracuse. So I think that, you know, that will be appealing to him. But I don't think he'll be overly moved by that. I think he understands that this is, you know, one of the very most important decisions a president makes. It usually far out lives you and could echo through the decades. I do want to pick up on the point when your conversation with Alexi about the Republicans might not be eager to have the court front and center. I think that's right. Listen, I think there's a lot of people who were surprised how easily Mitch McConnell acquiesced on the debt ceiling. And I think why he did that is he likes the hand he has right now. And he wants the Democrats to be front and center, not the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, I'm going to ask you to pick up on this, too. I mean, I think that The fractures in the Republican Party, and we'll talk about this later, are revealing themselves around two things right now. One is Russia. And there is sort of this, oh, bleep moment. What have we done? With Tucker Carlson leading the most energized aspect of the GOP over the cliff to isolationism and a full arms and legs wrapped around an American adversary and autocrat. The other is the idea that talking about the Supreme Court being out of step with the majority of public opinion, Sotomayor describing the stench that exists when the court makes decisions predicated on a state legislature saying, now we can do this because our guys are there, guys and gals. I don't think that's a winning issue for the kinds of voters Republicans want to get back.
I think this confirmation, Nicole, is going to go through, and I think it will go through pretty easily. It won't be an overly dramatic one. That being said, politically, what is the opportunity here? The problem that Democrats have had substantially over the past year is that grabbing on to Republicans has been hard. The Republicans have been a slippery target. The focus has been on the Democrats who control the levers of government right now. There has been an underemphasis on the extremism of the Republican Party, whether we're talking about the cover-up of the insurrection and assault on the Capitol, the attempted coup, Marjorie Taylor Greene, 47,000 other examples. So what this does is this allows for there to be an opportunity for Democrats to grab hold of the Republican Party and to shine a light on a fixed target, to get a handle on communicating the extremism, to be able to show it, to be able to show the disrespect that is directed at an African-American woman, to be able to show the hypocrisy, to be able to show the malice, to be able to show the extremism. So the Supreme Court becomes a theater. It becomes a stage for which this can all play out. And Democrats have to embrace the theater of that. They have to embrace the pluralistic, multi-ethnic, multiracial America that they embrace with this nomination, with this making of history, with this inclusion into the idea that, yes, Black women, too, can get to the top of American life and hold the most powerful offices in the land. So it's an opportunity. They will get the justice. The larger, more difficult point in this is, can they change the politics? Can they make it about Republicans and the extremism, as opposed to being in the defensive posture they've been in for too long now?
David Plouffe, you want to try to answer that? Can they? Will they?
Well, they have to, of course. Yeah. Any election, particularly when you're the one in power, if it is a referendum, I don't care who you are, you're going to lose it. It has to be a choice. Joe mm-hmm. Biden, one of Joe Biden's favorite expressions is, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. So perhaps Steve is right. Perhaps this is the opening chapter of what we need the book to be, which is let's really take a hard look at who you're going to put in power. And I think that can work with swing voters. I also think with the base, Nicole, this nomination, and I agree with Steve, it should be a pretty straightforward confirmation, will remind people the importance of having a Democratic Senate. Because yeah. if the Republicans take over the Senate, Mitch McConnell's not going to confirm any judge. You know, two Supreme Court justices could pass away in 23 and 24, and he won't do it. And the 24 cycle is really hard from a Senate standpoint for the Democrats. So this should be, a searing reminder and a great motivation for people to get out there and defend, of course, the House, but the Senate. Because if you lose that, then Joe Biden's ability, I think, to get any judges through in this next 2 years, sadly and tragically, and in an unprecedented way, that's what we're going to be facing.
Kimberly Akins-Store, I know we've been juggling some tech issues with you, but you inspired sort of this turn of this conversation in part with your comments yesterday that by putting the Supreme Court front and center and with the list, and let me put this list up again, of the names that are at least publicly circulating, and I think Steve and I both know a president can sometimes pull a name out that isn't being discussed. I don't know that either of us would advise that, but it does happen from time to time. This list and this confirmation and this process and this campaign promise made and a president elected in Jim Clyburn's words, in large part because of that promise made now being kept, does allow part of the conversation you started to have yesterday. Every issue before the Supreme Court disproportionately affects communities of color, whether it's voting rights, whether it's access to reproductive health care, whether it's some of the affirmative action cases that are before the court. Just talk about the opportunity Democrats have to have this conversation with the whole country around one of these exquisitely qualified nominees.
Yeah, it's an extremely crucial thing to be able to do. It's more than just deflecting attacks that these candidates are undoubtedly going to face, attacks that are meant to you know, frame them as somehow unqualified just because they look different and have different background from the plethora of white men who have ascended to the Supreme Court before them, but just at the importance of having courts, not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but all of our courts, be reflective of the communities that are affected by the decisions that they make. And so in that sense, it is the structural racism that has prevented a Black woman from being on the court so far. So this would be no time too soon. And as you said, every issue, whether it is about environmental issues that disproportionately affect communities of color, whether it is voting rights, which is the Supreme Court has already taken big swipes at and done a lot of damage, whether it's access to health care, certainly access to abortions, and any number of cases that are before the court, affirmative action being a crucial one as well. These affect everyone in America. And it's that lived experience. It's the same kind of lived experience, if you remember, that now Justice Sonia Sotomayor spoke about. Being someone who is Latina, who grew up in New York City in the projects and worked hard and went to Yale Law School and was editor of the Yale Law Review, but somehow was still being cast as if not only she were unqualified, but the fact that she talked about the importance of a diversity of lived experience that somehow that made her racist. That's the same thing. That's just a drop in the bucket to what the nominee that President Biden chooses will be facing in this. Not only do Democrats have to speak clearly in denouncing that, but they should speak clearly and unified about the importance of lived experience, about the importance of diversity, geographic diversity, diversity of backgrounds, diversity of work experience that need to be all throughout our judiciary in order to make more just rulings and to have rulings that impact, that take into effect how they will impact America.
I want to show you, Kim, something that Senator Mazie Hirono said. And again, this just goes with this idea of having the U.S. Supreme Court, its current makeup, in the news for the foreseeable future. It's about the myriad of issues this court has decided to act on.
We are going to see more of these 63 decisions. That is why you are seeing all these challenges that will end up to the Supreme Court, and I expect that same-sex marriage will be on the docket at some point, and there will be other cases like this that will be decided basically on ideological grounds. What I'm looking for, Andrea, is a justice who is fair and impartial, and that's not what we got with, in my view, with the three Trump nominees for the Supreme Court.
So, Kim, in the last 20 years since Gallup has been asking the question, the U.S. Supreme Court is at its lowest standing among the American people. It's lost 40% in terms of support. 20 years ago, 60% of the American people approved of this court's process and efforts, and just 40% do now. It seems that Senator Hirono is putting something out there that contributes to the low esteem in which the public holds this court, that they feel anything but impartial.
Yeah, and that is a big problem, as Justice Breyer said today at the White House. Everything in his comments was about the need to have trust, to have faith in our institutions, or that this experiment of democracy will fail. But it also speaks to the public seeing both the politicizing of the Supreme Court that has been done by the Senate, in the confirmation processes that we've seen, and also the growing politicizing of the court itself by the justices. They claim to not be Democratic or Republican justices or Bush or Obama justices, that they are just justices, but they have not acted that way in their decisions, in the way that they issue decisions, allowing restrictive abortion bans to go into effect without comment, for example, sort of silently allowing religious, you know, exemptions from pandemic requirements. I mean, they've been acting in a way that seems like they are putting a scale based on putting a thumb on the scale based on ideology, and that's being reflected in how people see them. And so it is important as we go through this confirmation process to have an eye on that, but to understand that is precisely why the faith in this court is being eroded.
I want to ask all of you to weigh in on Justice Breyer's comments in that White House event today, the rarest of things when a sitting Supreme Court justice resigns his seat, giving a president this extraordinary opportunity. More on that, more on the Supreme Court. We'll listen to those comments together. Plus, where are Republicans these days on the question of Russia and who they are to America? Well, they're divided whether or not to be for or against Vladimir Putin, or whether or not to attack Biden for being weak against Russia. The party only has Tucker Carlson to blame. The GOP struggling to find any safe spaces in their own party. We'll explain later in the program. It's International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it is supposed to be solemn and respectful and about paying tribute and remembering the atrocities that fell upon millions of Jews in this world at the hands of Nazis. Instead, because it's 2022 in America, a school board is banning a prize-winning book about those atrocities. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Stay with us.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I say I want you to pick just this up. It's an experiment that's still going on. And I'll tell you something. You know who will see whether that experiment works? It's you, my friend. It's you, Mr. High School Student. It's you, Mr. College Student. It's you, Mr. Law School Students. It's us, but it's you. It's that next generation and the one after that. My grandchildren and their children. They'll determine whether the experiment still works. And of course, I am an optimist, and I'm pretty sure it will.
We're back with our friends. Steve Schmidt, Justice Breyer choosing optimism there, but revealing, I think, an uncomfortable truth that we talk about here, that it is an open question whether this experiment will work out. Your thoughts?
There have been many times in our history where it has been an open question whether the American experiment would endure, whether it would survive, and that the country in those moments, through a combination of great qualities of character, courage, love, perseverance, wisdom, through unselfish leadership that came from surprising places, almost seemingly providentially, the country has endured. Government of the people, by the people, for the people that Lincoln talked about on the killing fields of Gettysburg. The idea of the country, that we can all be equal under the eyes of God, a creator, that is not granted to us by man's grant, by a king's grant, that we can live equally in a nation under the rule of law. The achievement of that, moving closer to the fulfillment of the ideal over the story of the history of the country, the perfection of the union. This is the obligation and duty of citizenship. This is what connects us to each other through the generations. This is what binds us to the 10,000 graves that face west back across the Atlantic Ocean of young men who died in Normandy to liberate France and to end Nazism on the European continent. And so the American legacy, the story of struggle to overcome the gap between our ideas and our ideals and our realities, that great story is what's at stake here, is what this is all about. And so when he talks with optimism, that optimism comes from the place that, looking back through history, we always have risen to the occasion. But that is not an entitlement, and it is not a guarantee that will continue in perpetuity. And so we face a test in this country at this hour, like our ancestors have. And whether we meet it or not, we'll face the judgment of history, as history's judgment falls on the great Americans of all races, creeds, and colors who have built the greatest country in world history.
Steve, do you share his optimism?
I think that there's no person who has ever won money betting against the United States of America. And at the end of the day, I have absolute faith that the majority of the American people want to live in a democracy, in a pluralistic society where we have freedom of speech, freedom of religion, where we have freedom of expression, and where we pick the leaders, and the leaders are accountable to us, the people, not ordered around by the leaders. And I think the American people understand the importance of democracy and liberty and the dignity of the human being, and understand that this is the only system of government that has ever existed in all of human history that puts the power and the dignity of the human being above the power of the state. And importantly, when you hear people like Newt Gingrich talking about locking up political opponents above the jackboot of the state.
Alexei, since we've been on the air, Mitch McConnell has said, let me get this right, he will give the president's nominee, quote, a fair look. No more detail than that. Also, since we've been on the air, my colleague Pete Williams, who of course, broke this news yesterday about Justice Breyer's retiring, has shared with us some statements from all of the justices, each more glowing than the other, having no limits based on ideology. It's clear that Justice Breyer was beloved by all of his colleagues. And I wonder if you can just weigh in on this moment, this opportunity, not just to add a fresh face and keep a campaign promise, but this bigger opportunity to have the conversation that Justice Breyer started today in the Roosevelt Room.
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked Steve whether he shares his optimism, because I was thinking to myself, I wonder what gives Justice Breyer so much hope. And then I thought, you know, he's seen a lot more than I have, respectfully, so I should defer to him and not be so cynical. But the thing I also was thinking about, Nicole, is he obviously recited that line referring to the Civil War that we may or may not still be engaged in. And what I keep thinking about is how remarkable it is, about how far we've come, that Michelle Childs, one of the women on the shortlist, is from the South. She is a Southerner, a Southern Black woman who would be a Southern voice on the Supreme Court when there are no current representatives from the South. And I think that is so important because it just reminds people, we talk about lived experiences and perspectives, but that in and of itself reminds people who Southerners are, what we can look like, how we can talk and act and where we go to school and what perspectives we bring. It's not just white folks. It's not just the white folks from the South who we know were engaged in the Civil War back in the day. And I just think that it's really remarkable to step back and know we've come so far.
Wow. You guys have all blown my mind today. Thank you so much. David Plouf, Kim Akinstor, Alexei McCammon, thank you for spending some time with us. Steve Schmidt sticks around. Axios is calling it the Tucker effect, how Republicans are talking about Russia. as the TV host with Kremlin talking points twists them all in knots. That story's next. Fox News' Tucker Carlson, who we already know has been questioning night after night after night why the theme in Washington is that Russia's bad, and asking why we'd be disloyal to side with Russia over our ally Ukraine. Well, he's now found it important to him to defend himself in the New York Times. Not very Tucker Carlson brand. He says this to them, quote, "Everything I've said about Russia and Ukraine strikes me as commonplace. It's obvious. I don't think my opinions are considered radical. I've never been to Russia. I don't speak Russian. Of course I'm not an agent of Russia." Here's what he's been telling his viewers for weeks on end.
So at this point, NATO exists primarily to torment Vladimir Putin, who, whatever his many faults, has no intention of invading Western Europe. Vladimir Putin does not want Belgium. He just wants to keep his Western border secure. That's why he doesn't want Ukraine to join NATO. And that makes sense. We don't get anything out of pushing Ukraine into NATO, so why are we doing this? The government of someplace called Ukraine is demanding that we fight the Russian army on their behalf. The question is, we're the United States, so why are we obeying them?
Carlson and his strain of Republican candidates, leery of the party's base that's still loyal to that pro-Russian sentiment you just heard, are driving a wedge in the party. It matters because they're undermining any American and, frankly, any Republican-like defensive response to a democracy seeking freedom from Putin and tyranny. The New York Times' Jonathan Weissman writes that their side of the party, quote, has questioned why the U.S. would side with Ukraine at all, has obliquely suggested with no evidence that the president is bolstering his son Hunter Biden's business interests, driven by a steady diet of pro-Russian or anti-interventionist rhetoric from the Fox News host Tucker Carlson. The Republican right has become increasingly vocal in undercutting not only U.S. foreign policy, but also the positions of the party's leaders. Axios reports today that Carlson is having an effect on how the Republican Party talks about the issue of Russia. Writing this, quote, GOP operatives working in 2022 primary races say they worry they'll alienate the base if they push to commit American resources to Ukraine or deploy U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Joining our conversation, former FBI counterintelligence agent Pete Strzok. Also joining us, John Cypher, former senior CIA officer who ran operations for the agency in Russia. He's now the co-founder of Spycraft Entertainment. And Steve Schmidt's still here. So, Pete Strzok, what? We put all that out there as a foreign policy predicament for America and for the Republican Party. But what does Russia see? And I've shown it here before. They play Tucker Carlson night after night after night. I don't know the translation, but they call him a, you know, honey pie or sweetie poop or whatever their term of endearment is. But they like him a lot. What does that do to America in terms of how Putin sees his successes here in co-opting Tucker, at least as a messenger?
Right. Well, I think this is an extraordinary gift for Putin. I mean, look, Tucker Carlson is walking proof that you don't need to be an agent to be a useful idiot. I think when the Russians and Putin and Russian state television see and hear what Tucker Carlson is saying, they see this as strong evidence about a split in American society. And not only within American society, but also kind of a continuation of the split that Trump encouraged during his administration about a withdrawal from NATO and our European allies. So for Putin, as he looks at the geopolitical environment of Russia, of Europe, I think Tucker Carlson's narrative is an extraordinary, powerful thing to wield against the United States, getting us to sort of turn our focus inwards, take our focus off of our European allies and the cause of democracy around the world.
And John Cypher, to what end? I mean, I see the evidence of it, and we cover it here. And I think what we've tried to uncover without complete success is who goes first. I mean, Putin taunted Biden by calling Ashley Babbitt a martyr. Tucker championed Ashley Babbitt. I mean, who's driving who, and what is the end game here for either party?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a political sickness in this country that, you know, there was this poll recently that came out that 62% of Republicans support Putin over President Biden, you know, and that's just, it's really shameful. You're, you know, Putin is someone who is willing to kill Americans. He's supported arms and support to the Taliban. He may have supported bounties against American soldiers. He's committed assassinations in Europe. He's bombed hospitals in Syria. He's undercut our elections and spread disinformation, anti-vax things. He has no love for America and actually no love for Republicans. And so all these people are doing is they're playing a Russian narrative, which is an anti-American narrative. He wants to humiliate the United States, and these people are helping him do it. And so in my sense, this is incredibly unpatriotic behavior.
You know, Tucker's not an idiot, Steve Schmidt. So what is driving this? And it's not something that he's correcting. He's doubling down. He's gone back to Hungary. He's got a special with Orban. I mean, the alliance is something that he's deepening, not walking away from.
I don't know what motivates him, but I suspect it is ambition for power. And I think it's very important to understand that Tucker Carlson shouldn't just be viewed as a Russian useful idiot, a Russian propagandist. He is a meaningful political figure in this country. Trump's successor is not going to be somebody who is like Diet Coke. It's not going to be a pale imitation like DeSantis. It will be an amplification. Someone like Carlson, someone like Youngkin, someone of that ilk. And so Tucker Carlson, should Trump not run, should Trump run, could be a very formidable candidate for the Republican nomination. And what he has awakened inside the Republican Party is this isolationist strain. He's really no different than the commentators that were rooting against England in 1939 and 1940. Isolationists, people who had fascist sympathies. He's somebody we know about his fetishization of Orban and Hungary, an anti-Semitic Central European autocrat from a country that was on the wrong side twice in both world wars. And so when we look at this moment, it's plainly obvious what Tucker Carlson has become. I think what we have to understand is that if Putin acts in Ukraine, if you have Russian aggression in Europe for the purposes of settling politics, the world order that emerged out of the Second World War, a war that killed 100 million people, will have ended effectively. And certainly, I think what it almost certainly guarantees is probably within a short period of time is an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese as the world order unravels and something much darker emerges in its place. And that's what's at stake here. And that's what's so disconcerting when you look at so much of the American right in this stage of its metastasis into this autocratic monstrosity that finds more in common with Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban and the rest of these people than it does with Joe Biden.
You know, Pete, I was part of the post 9/11 or you know, in the government for 9/11. And the analysis was this failure of imagination that some of our intelligence and government officials couldn't imagine an attack like that. This realignment that endangers America's ability to fight a war to protect our allies, something we're committed to in our treaties and by Article 5, seems the same kind of threat, but it's taking place in full view. What is the counterintelligence? What is the national security apparatus just to protect American national security interests?
Well, I think we need to be very cognizant of the fact that Russia and China are watching everything that we are doing very, very closely. And that's not just watching the administration to see what President Biden may be doing to try and figure out what the Department of Defense is doing, but they're paying full attention to Congress. They're paying full attention to both sides of the aisle. And as they have a calculus of, as they gather intelligence, trying to understand what their options are and what the United States' response might be, they are gathering all of this information to try and get an understanding of what their move and the United States counter move from that playing all those different scenarios out. So my concern is exactly what you said. And if there is movement in Ukraine, the concern is you have Germany already kind of not, you know, looking a little bit more to Russia than they have in the past. You have France who wants to heighten their influence in the European arena. And you have, you know, half of the Republican Party who wants nothing to do with it. And this is an outgrowth of, again, the Trump administration. And looking at everything they did with Ukraine, going back to try and pull, you know, the idea of lethal aid out of the Republican Party platform in 2016. So even our allies, they may be looking at Joe Biden saying, well, you appear to be a strong partner. But then when they look 2 years down the line and they see the prospect of a President Trump, or as Steve said, somebody worse or more sort of polarizing than President Trump, they have to be questioning whether or not they can count on the strength of America's commitment to the alliance. And that's what 4 years of Trump have brought us to. It's upended decades and decades and decades of a strong assurance that the United States would be right there next to him in the foxhole.
Yeah, I mean, weakening America's standing in the world as the GOP platform is just not something I thought I'd ever cover. We're going to ask the three of you to stay with us through a break. We'll be right back on the other side.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The president will reaffirm the United States' commitment to supporting Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and our commitment to nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. But this is more of a check-in call than it is a call where there is a specific announcement being delivered. We have said since last week that we have seen preparations and buildup at the border and that an invasion could come at any time. Our assessment has not changed since that point.
John Cypher, that was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki previewing the call. Since it concluded, President Zelensky tweeted this, had a long phone conversation with the president, discussed recent diplomatic efforts on de-escalation, agreed on joint actions for the future, thanked the president for the ongoing military assistance. Possibilities for financial support to Ukraine were also discussed. What is your sense, John, or your analysis of what Vladimir Putin is most likely to do at this point?
It's interesting. Vladimir Putin hasn't said much of anything for the last month, you know, but he's moved troops. He's moved things to the border. You know, what's interesting is Vladimir Putin has several things that he really cares about. He wants the U.S. out of Europe. He wants to kill off NATO. He wants vassal states that are supplicant to the Kremlin on his borders. But his actions, his bullying has created just the opposite. The U.S. is now talking about putting more troops into Europe. NATO is sort of re-energized. A year ago when President Trump was there, he was talking about pulling out troops and killing off NATO. Now it's re-energized. It realizes why it's doing what it's doing. And he's created a Ukraine that's going to be more Western-oriented and anti-Russian. And so, you know, I think if he sits back and realizes what's happening, he's essentially working against his own interests here. But He has wanted to humiliate the United States ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, when he believed the United States took advantage of Russia. It's not true, but that's the narrative that he believes. And if he thinks that we're particularly weak right now, that our politics are so inwardly focused and that we can't support this and we cannot deter him, he may choose to roll the dice and take this decision, which will be incredibly bloody, have huge refugee flows in Europe, will affect markets, oil markets. It's really a big deal, and Americans just start to pay attention.
John, do you agree with or accept this analysis that nobody, not even Vladimir Putin, knows what Vladimir Putin is going to do?
Yeah, I actually do. You know, that's a problem. If you're a dictator, he's been in power now for 20 years. There's, you know, we've learned a lot of things about him. You have to look at him, you know, in almost like an organized crime boss. You know, he's a career KGB officer. You know, he almost like the neighborhood bully. He looks for weakness. He can sniff out weakness. And in the past, when we've dealt with him, we've always left him off ramps. We've tried to think that if we accommodate him in some way, he'll come around. We've now learned that's impossible. He's decided that he wants to be the anti-Western leader. He wants to be the anti-American leader. He right now, he's been there 20 years. People probably don't tell him things because he's not going to be up for election. They don't have to worry about anybody on his side taking over for him. So he's going to do what he wants to do. And that's a scary prospect, because he's been there for 20 years and probably doesn't really know what things are happening in Ukraine and in the West right now.
Putin's going to Putin. John Cipher, Pete Strzok, Steve Schmidt, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We should tell you, Pete's book, Compromised, is now out in newly out in paperback. When we come back, New York City's very sad but massive farewell today to one of two young New York City police officers killed in the line of duty. We'll bring that to you next. It has been an incredibly emotional day in Midtown Manhattan, where thousands are gathered for a wake at St. Patrick's Cathedral for New York police officer Jason Rivera. Officer Rivera was one of two officers shot and killed while he was responding to a domestic violence call Friday night in Harlem. His funeral is set for tomorrow. Officer Rivera was just 22 years old, a native New Yorker who came from an immigrant family, and once said he joined the force to improve the often tense relationship between the police and communities of color like the one he belonged to. His partner, Officer Wilbert Mora, will be laid to rest next week. We will be right back.
I think they're so myopic in their focus, and they're so afraid of what's implied in having to defend the decision to teach Mao's as part of the curriculum, that it led to this kind of daffy, myopic response. And daffy would be easy. I mean, the problem, of course, is that it has the breadth of autocracy and fascism about it, and it has a real problem with asking the parents to be on board to decide what it's okay to teach the kids. And the values are too far away from those I can recognize to see how they got there.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. So today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It marks the 77th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It's a day to reflect on those atrocities, the atrocities committed against millions of Jews and other groups by the Nazis. A day to remind us of what happened so we make sure it never, ever happens again. It's a day that makes this hour's top story all the more alarming. The man you just heard from, if you didn't recognize him, is Art Spiegelman. He wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel called Maus, which is the German word for mouse. If you're not familiar with the book, here's a page from it. Maus tells the difficult story of Spiegelman's parents' time in a Nazi concentration camp and depicts Jews as mice and Nazis as cats. Spiegelman's comments earlier were in reaction to the decision by the McMinn County School Board in Tennessee to ban Maus from their eighth grade curriculum, a vote they made unanimously, citing the book's profanity and nudity. In an interview with CNBC, Spiegelman called the school board Orwellian for that action. This decision by the Tennessee school board was roundly condemned, with critics pointing out that the exposure to the horrors is exactly the book's point. Julie Gooden, a former history teacher who was at the school board meeting, said this, according to the meeting's minutes, quote, "I can talk of the history. I was a history teacher, and there's nothing pretty about the Holocaust. And for me, this was a great way to depict a horrific time in history." Mr. Spiegelman did his very best to depict his mother passing away. And we're almost 80 years away. It's hard for this generation. These kids don't even know 9/11. They were not even born. For me, this was his way to convey the message. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum weighed in last night when this news broke, quote, "Maus has played a vital role in educating about the Holocaust through sharing detailed and personal experiences of victims and survivors." On the eve of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, it is more important than ever for students to learn this history. Teaching about the Holocaust using books like Maus can inspire students to think critically about the past and their own roles and responsibilities today. Today of all days is a time to pay tribute to those who suffered and died and educate ourselves and our kids about what happened. And as we do, we must recognize the rise of anti-Semitic attacks and rhetoric that we have seen and we are seeing as of late in this country and the world. President Biden put out a powerful statement earlier marking this day, quote, "Today and every day, we have a moral obligation to honor the victims, to learn from the survivors, to pay tribute to the rescuers, and carry forth the lessons of last century's most heinous crime. From the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, to a synagogue in Colleyville, Texas, we are continually and painfully reminded that hate does not go away. It only hides. And it falls to each of us to speak out against the resurgence of anti-Semitism and ensure that bigotry and hate receive no safe harbor at home and around the world." And that is where we begin this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Rick Stengel is here. He's a former top State Department official and an MSNBC political analyst. Also joining us, Maya Wiley, former assistant U.S. attorney, now a civil rights attorney and MSNBC legal analyst. And Jonathan Greenblatt is back, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League and author of the book, It Could Happen Here. Jonathan, as much as I like seeing this much of you, you are here because the news keeps bringing us together. And this is not something I thought I would cover. The banning of books in general is deeply disconcerting, and the banning of Maus, explain why that's so dangerous.
Yes, I mean, as has been said, we are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past if we don't learn from them. And so on this 77th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp, it's appalling to think that a school district anywhere would take Maus out of its curriculum. And I mean, you know, to the extent that the school board pulled it because they thought there was use of profanity and nudity, what's profane and nakedly ignorant is to rob the next generation of knowledge. And yes, as you said in the lead-in, anti-Semitism is indisputably on the rise. The ADL, which tracks anti-Semitic incidents, has saw into the most recently the third highest total in America that we have ever seen. And so the data doesn't lie. We have got work to do to make sure the next generation, as survivors pass on and as memory fades, they understand the singular evil that was the Holocaust. And then we call out the people, Nicole, whether they are politicians making ridiculous anti-vaxxer statements or ugly persons sort of calling Israel a Nazi state. These are awful comparisons that have no place in a decent conversation.
You know, and Maya, I was thinking, reading about this today and, again, covering politics and our deep polarization extending into the classroom and feeling so jarred by it. I have a young son, and the thought of this is really disturbing to me on a personal level, but it's all on a continuum. I mean, as Jonathan just said, I mean, the underbelly has knitted these things together. This is Holocaust survivor Sidney Zoltak with a message for anti-vaxxers exploiting the Holocaust. He and his family spent 7 months in an underground bunker hiding from the Nazis, and he says this, quote, "We would go out at night to get fresh air occasionally, and often in the bunker, we could not breathe any air," he recalls. "There's nothing that I can compare it to, and I'm certainly not going to compare it to going through the COVID-19 pandemic. My aim was to live another day, and I did anything I could in order to live. My mother was the driving force. She gave us courage. She would say surviving is the most important thing for us. We have to survive." The debasement, and we try to pull it out and pull it up and focus on it, but Maybe it's the normalization of all of these most heinous slurs in our politics that ushers in this proliferation of anti-Semitism. What do you think?
Well, I certainly think that, unfortunately, we have seen a consistent rise, for the most part, in anti-Semitism over the years. And ADL has been one of the primary groups documenting that. But that one of the things that has changed and one of the things that we've seen as a jump in actual hate crimes against people who are Jewish or perceived as Jewish, which, by the way, in New York included a woman who spat on an 8-year-old child. outside of a yeshiva. That was just a few days ago. There are no bubbles. There are no places in which, even with a large Jewish population in New York, where there is freedom from this kind of hate. But that actually has been given a kind of permission. And unfortunately, it's a permission that has come from a right-wing normalization of anti-Semitism that we saw emerging with Trumpism. And I don't think we can separate those two things, because remember the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, mm-hmm. where we heard the extremely disturbing language that is nothing short of Nazism on the replace, Jews will not replace us. And the fact that that's also connected to some of the same political attacks that are anti-Semitic, can't be called anything else, against George Soros, a financier, but also a philanthropist, one of the most generous in the world, who has actually been bankrolling democracy across the globe, but also bankrupting, quite frankly, equality issues in the United States. And he has done that because of his experience as a Holocaust survivor, as a Hungarian Holocaust survivor. And I think we have to understand these attacks that are coming in political forms as attacks that are actually given permission to this kind of anti-Semitism. And I will say one other thing on a personal note.
Please.
Because my children, Red Mouse, in elementary school, and the reason they did is because their father is the son of a Holocaust survivor. And they needed to understand that not only are they descended from North American slaves from Maryland and South Carolina, they are descended from a woman and grandparents who had to survive Nazi Germany, luckily got out. Frankly, a story that is unimaginable. But the reality here is how much these stories connect us, from removing Mouse from a bookshelf and removing the 1619 Project or Toni Morrison. It is all the same. When they come for any of us, they are coming for all of us, and we all have to stand up to that.
Rick, I don't want to chunk this story up, so I'm going to ask you to, as the magazine editor, do the cover version, if you will. But I'm three things have come to mind since Jonathan and Maya have been talking. You know, one is that what was so alarming about the footage, and we decided not to play it again today, but anyone that watches this program knows that we covered it at the time. The Unite the Right rally attendees chanting Jews will not replace us were not masked. They showed their faces to cameras, and they did that in the light of day. So there is a permission structure for anti-Semitism and hatred in this country. I want you to talk about that. There's also increasingly a permission structure for banning books. Now, this isn't the first book that's been banned that we've covered here. And I want you to speak about those forces. And I feel like they're ascendant. I'd like your thoughts about that.
Yes, Maya's statement was very powerful. And to your question, Nicole, the truth is prejudice doesn't come in just one form. If you're prejudiced against one group of people, it's much more likely that you're prejudiced against others. If you hate one group of people, it's more likely that you will hate others. Racism and anti-Semitism are flip sides of the same coin. They're about racial supremacy. And speaking of racial supremacy, that's what we saw in the Unite the Right rally, white supremacists who have been given tacit permission, as Maya said, by the forces of Trumpism that rose even during the Obama administration in opposition to a black president. There is a permissive structure for that in our society now that's just very, very, very dangerous. I mean, but one of the reasons we're talking about the Holocaust on Holocaust Remembrance Day is that the memory of it is fading. There was a poll in 2018 that showed 66% of millennials couldn't identify Auschwitz, that they couldn't identify how many Jews perished in the Holocaust. You know, these terrible tragedies, whether it's slavery, whether it's the Holocaust, have to be taught again in every generation. You can't be inoculated against the ignorant. And so that is what we have to do as our society, and we're not doing that, just like we're not doing that with civic education. And the banning of books, as you say, and the permission that's been given to that structure look, I think parents have to look at, you know, after their kids. But that I saw one of the men on the Tennessee school boards acting like a literary critic about Mao, saying, well, I didn't think this needed to be there and I didn't think that needed to be there. That's not how we get rid of these things. We get rid of these things by teaching the horror and teaching that horror in every generation so it never, ever happens again.
Jonathan, I want to ask you what that looks like. What does turning away from these forces look like? And how do you sort of bring the most people along with you?
Well, I'll share a thought on that. And I just really want to say how moved I was by Maya's story and what she shared about what she did with her children. And I also need to remind all of us that anti-Semitism existed before Donald Trump, and it will persist long after. And while it's certainly true that there are some on the right who indeed, fomented by Trumpism, a kind of extremism entered our political dialogue, every year the Islamic Republic of Iran runs a Holocaust denialism cartoon contest. Jews got beaten up in broad daylight in Times Square, on La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles and across the country last May after the fighting in Gaza, and none of the assailants were wearing MAGA hats. Okay, they were using their animus against the Jewish state to justify hatred and violence against Jewish people. All of that is wrong, no matter where the anti-Semitism comes from. So that being said, how do we, to paraphrase Richard, inoculate our children against intolerance? We've got to teach the Holocaust. We've got to use innovative ways to express the message. You know, that might mean thinking about how we reimagine social media, which we know is like intravenously feeding billions of people disinformation every day. They should not allow Holocaust denialism and use their platforms to educate people about these issues. And then I think in classrooms across the country, Nicole, Holocaust education should be mandatory. The data shows us that young people who learn about the Holocaust show higher appreciation for pluralism and tolerance. We've done the surveys at ADL. And there's lots of great curricula out there that colleges, high schools, and yes, middle schools could be introducing to teach our young people about this singular evil in human history.
Maya, I want to come back to you, give you a chance to respond to Jonathan, but also ask you to weigh in. I had it in the last block, but Tucker Carlson has a new program, I believe, with Viktor Orban that is attacking George Soros. I mean, it's not just social media. I mean, there's been a platforming of more than flirting with anti-Semitism on broadcast networks with some of the right's biggest stars.
Look, so first of all, Jonathan's absolutely right that anti-Semitism was with us before Donald Trump. Racism, Islamophobia, all forms of hate predated it, and we were seeing a rise in it. Highest levels, though, recently since 2008. And we have to do education to combat it. But look, you know, your point, I think, is really important, Nicole, which is there has been a concerted media machine that has said and paired people who have viewpoints on civil rights, on, you know, making sure that we're ensuring democracy in countries that are becoming dictatorships, quite frankly. George Soros has been on the leading edge of that as someone with resources that he's given through philanthropy, but he's also angered some on the right and some Republicans because he's also been a big political donor. And I say that to say, you know, that's his First Amendment right to give to whom he wants to. But the fact that the attacks are anti-Semitic in nature and that we see a Tucker Carlson actually supporting what is an anti-democratic government in Hungary and using those ties to essentially do something that we've seen with hate is that it is global and that we're not immune from it in the U.S., but certainly the globalization of the connections between right-wing extremists is something that we have to be very concerned about because that only empowers it. And I just want to say that, you know, Jonathan's absolutely right about education, and it also requires us to have more relationships with one another. Because as long as we don't mm-hmm. know each other, it is so easy to divide us. And the truth is we have so much more in common with one another than we do with things that we don't have in common. And it doesn't come with segregation. It doesn't come with denial. And it doesn't come with a refusal to read or speak to each other.
So, Rick, you take all of that sort of collaboration and knitting together and give and take. And just to be perfectly blunt, there's a real limit to my reach here to who'll see this conversation. And a lot of the rise, and as Jonathan said, not all of it, but a lot of it, especially the braid of book banning, anti-Semitism and racism, happens on the right. How do you break into that echo chamber?
I don't know. It's hard to penetrate. I mean, I was thinking about what Maya was talking about, the globalization of hatred, and we've seen that. And I'm going to bring this back to the news, and it seems like a little bit out of left field. But I remember when I went to Kiev in Ukraine in 2014 and saw swastikas all over the Maidan, which is where the protests began. Let's remember, Ukraine was the place where more Jews lived before World War II than any other country in the world. And according to the Holocaust Museum, there were 1.5 million Jews who were killed, assassinated during the Holocaust in Ukraine, beginning in 1941, where the Nazis invaded. These are issues that have been around long before us, and unfortunately will be there long after us. I mean, just the way disinformation flourishes in times of uncertainty, conspiracy flourishes during times of uncertainty, that's the same thing with racism and anti-Semitism. Remember during the plague, what was the greatest canard of all? That Jews were poisoning the wells. That was the reason that people were dying. So I have to say the one-size-fits-all solution is education, but we're competing against rising ignorance and rising authoritarianism where people don't want to teach hard truths. So it's a very uphill battle, but one that we all need to make.
Rick Stengel has a singular ability to make me feel uninformed when he says, remember during the last plague. No, I had to go look it up. Rick Stengel, Maya Wiley, Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate all of you. I want to tell all of our viewers that the author of Mouse will be my colleague Joy Reid's guest tonight at 7 p.m. Don't miss that. When we come back, a new strategy to hold lawmakers accountable for their roles in the Capitol insurrection, a legal case that could disqualify far-right North Carolina Congressman Madison Cawthorn, unless that is, he can prove that he's not an insurrectionist. We'll tell you about that. Plus, the effort to push through President Joe Biden's nominee to replace Supreme Court Justice Breyer. Democrats are promising a speedy process. We'll ask a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee what that looks like. And later, one of the most outrageous examples of how Republicans are weaponizing redistricting may be in the city of Nashville, where a longtime Democrat is calling it quits, saying the GOP dismembered his House district. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Stay with us.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Stuart Rhodes, he's the leader of the Oath Keepers, who's facing seditious conspiracy charges in connection with the January 6th insurrection, was denied bail today by a judge, actually late yesterday. That judge labeled Rhodes a flight risk due in part to the, listen to this, elaborate escape tunnels he had installed in his own backyard. Rhodes and other members of the Oath Keepers are the first insurrectionists to face sedition charges, but the government has yet to reveal any real consequences for some of the most visible instigators of the January 6th riots. A group of lawyers is trying to change that, though, filing a suit to disqualify North Carolina Congressman Madison Cawthorn from the ballot unless he can prove that he is not an insurrectionist. They point to Cawthorn's history of promoting violence against the government. Watch.
Call your congressman and feel free, you can lightly threaten them and say, you know what, if you don't start supporting election integrity, I'm coming after you, Madison Cawthorn's coming after you.
When tyranny becomes law, rebellion becomes your duty. The Second Amendment was written so that we can fight against tyranny. These people do not have your best interest at heart. I highly recommend, as much fun as we have targets shooting, we all need to be storing up some ammunition. And I'll tell you, anybody who tells you that Joe Biden was dutifully elected is lying.
if our election systems continue to be rigged and continue to be stolen, then it's going to lead to one place, and it's bloodshed. And I will tell you, as much as I am willing to defend our liberty at all costs, there's nothing that I would dread doing more than having to pick up arms against a fellow American.
Let's bring into our conversation Harry Lipman, former U.S. attorney and former deputy assistant attorney general, and Charlie Sykes, columnist and editor at large for The Bulwark and an MSNBC contributor. So I want your legal analysis, Harry, and I'm reminded of something my colleague Savannah Guthrie said to Donald Trump, you know, when she was asking him about whether he believed in QAnon. And she said, well, you're not someone's crazy uncle. You knew the president. What is QAnon? And he said, I don't know anything. They're really good on pedophile. I mean, Bass and Cawthorn isn't just anyone talking about taking up arms against the government. His salary is paid by the taxpayers, a member of Congress. Does he face any extra freedom or latitude or any extra scrutiny because of that? Tell me your analysis of this case.
Yeah, he has to be qualified. We're talking about the Constitution and words of the Constitution. This is sort of novel. By the way, it's just like Trump going around originally saying Obama wasn't born here. He was saying he's not qualified to be president. Happens all the time. People say you don't live in that district. You're not old enough. No difference. You are not qualified. It's a qualification under the Constitution if you swore an oath to the Constitution. Of course, he did when he was seated before, and then engaged in an insurrection. Well, did he? You properly said, Nicole, a really big part of this case, he's going to have to prove it because North Carolina law says once you come forward with some evidence that someone engaged, or and that just means under North Carolina law, help did something useful to an insurrection. And everyone, we talked about this last week, has called this an insurrection. You've got to prove that you're qualified now. He's going to have to actually bear the burden of proof. He's going to be deposed and explain why he didn't engage in it. And I know it's a novel proposition, but it's been used. It was passed after the Civil War, was used in the 20th century, and it's the simple words of the Constitution. If he can't prove that he did not engage or help out an insurrection, he's not qualified, same as if he's 24 years old, and a court will say in his state, I'm sorry, you may not sit. You may not be even on the ballot.
Charlie, yeah. I want to ask you how you see this, and you're welcome to add any legal analysis. I want to read a little bit from the New York Times reporting on this. I don't think we can have those persons who have engaged in acts of insurrection elected to office and serving in office in violation of their constitutional duties and oath. That's John Wallace, one of the lawyers on the case and a campaign finance and election law expert in Raleigh, North Carolina. He adds this, quote, it should not be difficult to prove that you're not an insurrectionist. It only seems to be difficult for Madison Cawthorn. What do you think?
Well, okay, I am not a lawyer, and I will have to say that when I first heard about this, I was very skeptical because this is a very novel legal maneuver. It is kind of a reach. However, having read Harry's piece in the New York Times about it, I'm intrigued because what it really comes down to is the question of qualifications and accountability. Are we going to hold elected officials accountable for their behavior? Because so far, most of the focus has been on the people who actually invaded the Capitol, not the people who have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, who may have been involved in inciting that attack. And so I am intrigued by watching how this plays out, how it will shine the legal spotlight on people like Madison Cawthorn, and maybe, if it's successful, on people like Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Green, Paul Gosar, and ultimately on the former president himself, because at some point it comes down to the question of accountability. Are these individuals going to skate while others are arrested and go to jail? Is anyone above the law in our system, including the former president of the United States? So I think this is intriguing and worth watching.
I want to read some of your piece, Harry, because most of what I know, I understand from your piece as well. But I want to ask you this question. I mean, it's an open question whether anyone's going to be held accountable for the insurrection, who's actually responsible for it. And so far, the two voting rights machines companies have the cases that have gone the farthest and for the most money against the Fox News anchors who platformed the lies and folks like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. talk about what the sort of limitations are in terms of holding elected officials accountable.
I mean, it does seem at every turn there look to be some kinds of problems. Oh, here's executive privilege. Oh, there they've delayed the courts. And, you know, you're right. There are a dozen different ways, but some of them do look like they could bear fruit. I think we've just gotten used to thinking no way true accountability will come about except historically. But, you know, I think the forgery case now that's blooming against many stakeholders could have promise. And one more thing I'll add about this one. The delay strategy is impossible. North Carolina is going to have a ballot and it's going to have Cawthorn on it or not by May. They've got to do that same thing in the other states. So they're going to determine. And it's what they're going to determine is, did he engage in an insurrection? So it's one of many theories. I take Charlie's point, intriguing, et cetera. But if you're lawyerly about it and go to the terms of the Constitution, It's a pretty weighty potential claim.
Charlie, just back this up for us. Who is Madison Cawthorn and how did he happen?
Oh, there's a long story there, and it is not a pretty one. You know, he's part of this new generation of basically glorified trolls who've gone to Congress, who have no interest in legislating, who exist on social media, play to the grassroots base, and have become celebrities. You know, this is a guy whose background on paper, the lies he's told about his past, his relationship with women would normally be disqualifying on Earth 2.0. So it's really quite a commentary that someone like a Madison Cawthorn or a Marjorie Taylor Greene would become celebrities in this Republican Party. But again, I think it's important that we find some mechanism for making these representatives answer for the kind of rhetoric that they engaged in, the role that they played in the attempt to subvert democracy. Because once again, and I know we've used this phrase too often probably on this show, which is none of this is normal and we can't treat it as normal, which means that when I say, Harry, that it's intriguing, it's also a recognition that perhaps we need to look to different tools. We need to look to elements of the U.S. Constitution that have been overlooked for the last century and employ whatever we can in order to, you know, save our democracy.
Well, and it's an indictment of the political process because you used to be able to rely on fact checkers and the truth, right. And opposition research existed in both parties because the truth about someone used to disqualify them among voters. That whole pact is totally broken on the right. The more awful, the more electable in the Trump Republican Party. Harry Lipman, Charlie Sykes, thank you so much spending some time with us on this. We'll stay on it. When we come back, President Joe Biden vows to name a black woman to the United States Supreme Court by the end of next month. Democrats and the Senate Judiciary Committee want the confirmation process to move just as quickly, and we'll hear from one of them. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut is our next guest. Don't go anywhere.
Once I select a nominee, I will ask the Senate to move promptly on my choice. In the end, I will nominate a historic candidate, someone who's worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy, and someone who, like Justice Breyer, will provide incredible service on the United States Supreme Court.
It was President Joe Biden earlier today promising that he will announce his pick for the Supreme Court by the end of February, and that his nominee will be a black woman, as promised. In the weeks between now and then, Senate Democrats, led by Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin, will formulate their plan for the confirmation process, whomever the president's nominee should be. According to the New York Times, Durbin intends, quote, to move a nominee expeditiously through the process, but a person familiar with his thinking cautioned that the split nature of the committee could prompt delays if Republicans try to drag out the process. Joining us now is Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. He's a member of the Judiciary Committee. Senator, thanks for being with us. First, before this retirement was in the news, did you already have a plan for confirming the president's nominee whenever this occasion should present itself?
I think our approach in thinking about it has been that we're going to be quick and expeditious, but fair. And the country deserves this nominee to be moved quickly and fairly. But we really have an exciting opportunity to confirm the first Black woman who will be a strong voice and a face that reflects our country's immense diversity and the tremendous talent that she will bring, and I hope will actually gain bipartisan support.
Is the goal to move as quickly as Coney Barrett's confirmation sped through the Senate, or is that an artificial period of time?
There's nothing in the Constitution that sets forth a period of days or weeks, as you know, no statute or even rule of the Senate. But I think we can draw some inspiration from Justice Breyer's own service. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, having argued cases before him on the United States Supreme Court and having served as a law clerk, I've argued four cases in the court, that he brought a view of the world that recognized the real world consequences of these seemingly abstract decisions. And he tried to bring together a deeply divided court. And that's the kind of consideration we should bring to this confirmation process, trying to bring our colleagues together. We've already begun reaching out to Republicans, and I really hope that the nominee from President Biden will have such a compelling life story and such impressive qualifications that there'll be an undeniable dynamic here and that our Republican colleagues will join us.
And there's at least one candidate who's already garnered the support of, I believe, three of your Republican colleagues. Do you have any thoughts or insights into any of the names that are circulating that you want to share with us?
We have a deep bench, Nicole. We're very fortunate, literally on the bench and also in the legal community, to have Black women who are immensely qualified. And I'm going to be really proud to support them. I hope Republican colleagues will put aside the partisan differences, that we'll really have a bipartisan proceeding and that we will move quickly. I think that's really important. Think about it for a moment. You know, our United States Supreme Court has never been so threatened in its credibility, never so much at risk in terms of its authority and independence. Part of the wounds have been self-inflicted by the court, but also partly the result of the very partisan pitched battles that we've had for prior nominees. And there's a higher good here and a public interest that will be vindicated by moving quickly. But we are prepared to fight. Make no mistake. We are prepared to fight ferociously and use all the options we have to get this job done. It's a job that will get done. This nominee will be confirmed.
I want to switch gears and ask you about a comment you made on a call with Ukrainian Americans about their concerns about the rhetoric coming from the right. And it was your sense that some of the pro-Russia rhetoric that is furthered by Tucker Carlson and some of the loudest voices on the right isn't necessarily the view of elected Republican officials. But you made this comment that they are not willing to say it publicly. Quote, most Republicans are only willing to disown it in private. Does it weaken this president, and is that on purpose?
It weakens the country for Republicans to fail to disown that Republican fringe, maybe not even Republican, far right fringe talk about favoring the Russians rather than Ukrainians. The Russians are threatening to really upset and attack the entire world order as it has existed since the Second World War. And we are coming to the aid of a partner that is not a NATO member, but deserves our full support in terms of sanctions, economic sanctions, and military aid. I've urged that those sanctions be applied now before an invasion. But most important, that far-right rhetoric serves Putin's playbook, which is to divide us within the United States, divide us from our allies, divide our allies among each other. And we need a clear and explicit voice from the Germans that they will stop Nord Stream 2. I've opposed it from the outset, but the Germans need to say they will stop those natural gas purchases. Again, the far right rhetoric only strengthens the divisions between Germans and ourselves. And I think we need to stand strong as a democracy, clearly with the world order at stake. And the message that our delegation recently, last week, in fact, brought to the Ukrainians, President Zelensky, the foreign minister, the defense minister, is that we're united in a bipartisan way to stand with them. And the far right fringe, I think, doesn't represent that bipartisan solid unity.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you so much for spending some time with us on all these topics. We're grateful.
Thank you.
When we come back, the Tennessee Democrat whose Nashville district is being gutted by Republicans in what may be the most egregious example of redistricting we've seen yet, will show you how they are dismembering his district in his words. Back with that after a quick break.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
As you all know, modern Republican scheming runs the gamut. Some of it is plainly illegal. We'll wait and see what the Justice Department does with those fake electors we've been talking about. But there are other plots, too, ones that skirt the line of legality but are no less anti-democratic. Take what's happening to Tennessee's 5th Congressional District right now. After 16 terms, Congressman Jim Cooper, a Blue Dog Democrat reelected time and time again, will retire because of the way Republicans, quote, savaged and dismembered Nashville. Here's how The Guardian visualized it. This is what the area surrounding that city looks like, or looked like, in previous elections. Tennessee's 5th District is in the middle, in blue. Joe Biden won there by 24 points in 2020, but a new redistricting plan, simply awaiting the governor's signature, would take a cleaver to the district, chopping it into three to be absorbed by new districts, districts that Trump would have won by 12, 15, and 30 points. It's a dramatic example of something that's happening all across this country, and another way that Republicans plan on regaining legislative majorities by any means necessary. Joining us now is Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee. He represents Nashville and Middle Tennessee. Congressman, I understand how this happened, but what can be done to stop it?
Well, Nicole, you've asked the right question, and you framed it so well. Republicans are basically cheating. They haven't been able to elect a Democrat in Nashville for 100 years. This isn't about me. So now they're getting rid of Nashville politically. They're colonizing Nashville. It's completely outrageous. Now, Democrats have gerrymandered in the past, but the simple truth is we're not very good at it. This is brutal. This is tough. And they've hidden all the records. Their Republican redistricting guru explicitly told them no texts, no emails, no written record. So their racial gerrymandering can never be found out. So I hope a lawsuit will succeed. We're trying everything possible. I've thought of everything. And I just don't think there's any way, certainly for me, to have a chance in this election. And that's their intention. I take it as a compliment.
Does the federal voting rights legislation get us, does it travel any distance toward protecting about this at a national level? Or does this need to be solved state by state?
Well, if we'd passed H.R. 1 and the Senate had approved it, that would have helped. If we had the old Voting Rights Act, that would have helped. If we'd overcome the Supreme Court Shelby decision, that would have helped. But with what we got now, we got very few tools to work with.
I mean, as you just said, it's 0 for 3, right? The three tools that existed so that Republicans couldn't engineer their electorates as opposed to voters engineering who represents them. Do you think that changes the political calculus? Do you think a public education campaign? I mean, it feels, you look at the redistricting, it's not just happening to you, it's happening all over the country. It feels worse than ever.
Well, I hope this wakes people up. And since this only happens every 10 years, we tend to forget the lessons we learned 10 years before. But I've been warning people in Nashville for a year, and I couldn't get the Nashville Chamber of Commerce to protect Nashville. You know, they just don't believe it. I thought it was Paul Revere. They thought it was Chicken Little. Turns out I was Paul Revere. And it's not the British coming. It's folks who are so extreme, they're not recognizable by regular Republicans. Tennessee is a state that had Howard Baker, Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, Bill Frist, respectable Republicans. And now there's this crazy fringe out there that is terrifying even Republicans, but seldom are they willing to speak out about it. So I'm hopeful that it'll be truth-telling and the Republican Party will turn to its Abraham Lincoln roots, because Nashville was a Union stronghold in the Civil War. You know, people forget that. All the surrounding counties were the Confederates. Now it's looking like the Confederates are winning.
It is an unbelievable wake-up call, and it's a conversation we hope you'll continue to have with us. Congressman Jim Cooper of Nashville, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
Quick break for us. We'll be right back. Before we go, it's been an exciting afternoon here at MSNBC, having to do with a pretty major update to our programming. First of all, everybody loves Joe, Mika, and Willie. Well, it was announced this morning that Morning Joe is getting an entire extra hour. They will now be on the air from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern. So you may ask, what happened to the always outstanding Stephanie Ruhle? Well, she is moving to the 11th hour to take over for our dear friend Brian Williams. Obviously, that is great news for early birds and night owls. Congratulations to Steph and the entire Morning Joe team. We'll be watching from morning to night. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.